Thank you very much. It is really a pleasure for me as organizer, and I'm sure for everyone in the program to be here and to enjoy this nice atmosphere of the Institute. For that one has to pay, so this is one of the prices we'll have to pay. I hope Paco will not escape and we'll give another one at the end of the program to report what we have achieved. So I think I have a little bit easier task to describe where the field stands and what are the what are some of the issues we think are interesting from the point of view of theoretical physics. And that has what I'm going to describe today somehow was addressed in the conference we had a week ago, in which one of the topics discussed very heavily was physics of bilayer graphene. What I'm going to do in this seminar, I describe the basics of monolayer and bilayer graphene physics, starting from single particle picture and then going into the issues related to the interactions. And I oscillated between two ways to approach this lecture. One, to start with the lattice and then to do it like a systematic analysis, starting from the lattice symmetry and going into fields. And then I realized that for particle physicists in the audience, it will be extremely boring, so that I start with something which would be closer to field theorists, would look sexier and more beautiful. And then I start adding the ugly things which make life more difficult and in some sense more interesting. So the starting point, therefore, for me will be to write down two Hamiltonians, one describing electrons in monolayer graphene and the other describing electrons in the bilayer graphene. For the monolayer, this Hamiltonian has the... By the way, is it the good size of letters? Everyone says. The monolayer, this is the Dirac Hamiltonian that is, which makes monolayer graphene so popular as an example of a system where relativistic physics can be investigated. And in the bilayer graphene, the Dirac physics takes a very funny shape, at least in the relatively broad range of energies of electron in the band structure. This one looks quite similar to the Dirac Hamiltonian, except that instead of the momentum of the electron, there is some vector, two-component vector, which is composed, which is quadratic in the absolute value of the momentum of the electron, also multiplied by the object which is the Pauli matrix. And you can say that the difference between these two Hamiltonians is that if you start bearing the direction of the electron momentum on the 2D plane, then this vector that sends in the bilayer instead of the momentum in the monolayer just rotates twice faster than the direction of the electron momentum. Now, these two Hamiltonians, they characterize, or in a two-dimensional space, they characterize particles which have singular properties in the band structure. Singularity is exactly at the value of momentum zero. And this singularity is related to some topological characteristic, which some people call a Berry phase, some people call a winding number. And the way how you can see it is either by following the eigenstates of the electron with of an electron plane wave, which are two-component spinners, and then by varying the direction of the electron momentum on the plane, so that I rotate the momentum by the angle of 2 pi, then this state adiabatically evolves into the wave function, which is just different by sine minus 1 from the one you had before you started the evolution. You can track this by saying that the eigenstates of such a Hamiltonian are particles which have the direction of this spin operator aligned with the direction of the electron momentum. And then when you rotate the electron momentum on the plane, since the isospin, or we call it isospin, is stuck to the direction of the electron momentum, the wave function, the state, evolves as if you rotated the isospin around the axis perpendicular to the plane, and this evolution is operated by the matrix sigma z, and after you rotate it by the angle momentum by the angle of 2 pi, then you acquire the additional factor of e to the I pi. On the other hand, you can also look at this characteristic as the winding number of the direction of the electron moment of the electron isospin when you go around the center of the momentum space, and this winding number for the vector, unit vector sigma, is equal to 1. For the bilayer, this characteristic is simply doubled, so that instead of the periphase of pi, the periphase now has to be regarded as 2 pi, simply because this vector here will rotate twice faster than the direction of the electron momentum itself. All the rest can be seen as exactly the same behavior, except that the spinners, which correspond to the plane wave, they have two components related by the phase factor, which is dependent on the direction of the electron momentum in the plane. This angle theta is the characteristic of the direction of the electron momentum. And then you can apply the definition of the periphase, for example, to find that the formal periphase for such two-component vectors that these two-component vectors acquire upon a adiabatic evolution would be 2 pi instead of pi. Now, for anyone who is familiar with periphases or with winding numbers, it becomes very suspicious that there is 2 pi, which is somehow distinct from 0. And what I would like to show a little bit later is that there is some algebra, not really algebra, but arithmetics of periphases of winding numbers that can be traced by some mechanical operation on the physical sheet of bilayer graphene, so that one can really see that the singularity in the spectrum of bilayer electrons can be attributed the periphase of 2 pi or the winding number in 4 to 2 in contrast to the winding number 1 in the monolayer. Now, what I also want to do with this Hamiltonian is I'll rewrite it a little bit differently. This is just for my own convenience. I'll write it in the form of a 2x2 matrix. So this operator pi will be px plus I qy. And the bilayer will look very similar. And I'm doing that in particular to prepare the form, which will be very useful to employ simultaneously for the monolayer and bilayer. This will have the form of pi dagger square here, pi square here, with the factor of 1 and 2. So I call this combination of px plus iqy an operator. Because at some point I'll start employing some vector potential of electromagnetic field or magnetic, corresponding to magnetic field, and after that the momentum components will become really the operators rather than the parameters. Now another thing that makes systems interesting, or and actually both of them, is that electrons interact. And now I have to make a statement that negates some of the positive expectation that now we have two-dimensional system with two-dimensional quantum electrodynamics. We don't have any two-dimensional quantum electrodynamics here, because all the electromagnetic fields we can use are three-dimensional. Therefore, when I write down some interaction, so here I'm writing down the interaction components, I have to stick to the three-dimensional Poisson interaction. It should be here. And this is the difference from what a real quantum electrodynamics in two-dimensional world would be. The interaction would have to be taken as two-dimensional, not three-dimensional. And in addition to this, I have to add something else, which is also specific to the material, which is a set of short-range interactions which come from the structure of the atomic orbitals to which these electrons in graphene belong. And these short-range interactions, they somehow should respect the, write this a little bit better, they have to respect the group symmetry requirement set by the lattice structure of the crystal. And those short-range interactions, they are interactions of fluctuations in the electronic system that locally violate the symmetry of the crystal and interact, again, according to the symmetry requirements, with another local interaction at the same place, which violates the symmetry of the crystal in the same way. So we have the long-range interaction, the Coulomb part, and we have the short-range interaction, which is the result of underlying crystalline lattice. Talking about the Coulomb interaction. So these are the fluctuations in the local density operator, described by the local density operator.
Here. Local density is over here.
This is local density, but there is a lattice structure. There is a lattice structure which now has to be taken into account. And this lattice structure at short distances can be violated by how electron states fluctuate. So this, you can say that these are some high-order electric or magnetic moments of the electrons which belong to the orbitals which sit on the underlying crystalline lattice.
And is rho hat quadratic in electrons' field?
Yes. So each of those, I'll specify somehow a little bit later. And each of those characterizes how fluctuation in the electronic liquid violates the symmetry of the crystal.
Capital R is a representation of the crystal group?
Yes. And I have done some homework in the corner because I'll refer to that. And well, in fact, I just wanted to show that I know the representation of the group C6. And I'm proud of that. Now, so what I wrote here, the first part didn't cause any questions, the second part did. And this is about the situation that we have in the field, because those constants, we don't really know them. And at the end, I'll make a statement that the way how the field theory gets renormalized in monolayer and bilayer for those constants is quite different. And in the bilayer, the normalization of this constant is extremely interesting, mainly to phase transitions at low energies for the electron liquid. And the unknown part of what I'm going to talk about is about what exactly happens in a pure ideal bilayer undoped, so that chemical potential of the electrons will be exactly at where the positive and energy bilayer parabolic bands touch each other at one point in the momentum space. Now, before I go into that, I would like to add a little bit of excitement here to say that the part that we do know about, and we may think we know everything about because there is nothing but electron charge here and nothing else. Maybe there is some the electric susceptibility of the medium, which we have to take into account, but I ignore the said. This looks like we know everything about, so we can look how strong it is. And the matter of fact is that for monolayer, the final structure constant with the velocity v, which is only 1/300 of the speed of light, the final structure constant is larger than 1. So that interaction in the monolayer is strong, and quite big business in the field is to analyze what does it lead to in the monolayer physics. In the bilayers, what you have to do to compare, to look on the strengths of the interaction, is you have to compare the interaction energy between electrons at some length scale related to the electron wavelengths to the kinetic energy of the electron with a similar wavelength. And this kinetic energy is quadratic in the electron momentum. So this is the band energy. And from that, you can conclude that there is some characteristic wavelength scale, so that if the electron wavelengths or the momentum are smaller, wavelengths is large, so large that they're larger than the characteristic one, then the interactions are the dominant, are very strong. You cannot treat them just as a small perturbation. I'm speaking about the Coulomb part. And this length scale is estimated from this condition. It is the same as the Bohr radius, except that I have to use the effective electron mass, which is for graphene quite small as compared to the mass of the free electron. And the lengths that you derive from that is of the order of 20 angstroms, which is quite short, and which means that interactions, the Coulomb interaction itself in bilayers is quite strong, and it has to be dealt with a care. Don't expect me to jump straight away into conclusions what interactions do, because there is a couple of things I have to describe about what's written in the middle of the board before I would be able to come to this conclusion. And also, I would like to introduce you into the hard or more material specific part of the problem, which is related to the underlying crystal, to the fact that we have a system of carbons which are arranged into a honeycomb lattice. In the case of the bilayers, these are two honeycomb lattices sitting on the top of each other, organized in a particular way corresponding to Bernoulli's second. The reason why The lattice for bilayer has such a form theoretically is because we just take it as a part of the three-dimensional crystal of graphite. That's how it has been created by exfoliation, and also because it has been found and has been justified by DFT calculations at the lower energy state of the two lattices together. And what I want to do at this point is to explain how these simple Hamiltonians, they appear from the lattice. I have to be fair, I'll have to add a couple of things to show how things get complicated. When you take into account that you start with lattice model and have a finite bandwidth, and then there are features of the band structure which reflect the existence of the finite bandwidth. To talk a little bit about the crystalline symmetry and then to come back to the interaction problem.
Can the separation between the planes be tuned?
Not really. It's a minimum in the energy. The way how one can perturb the bilayer graphene, I'll describe also a bit later. I'll start first with the unperturbed arrangement, which corresponds to the minimum of energy of the two lattices taken together. And then I'll tell you a little bit what external perturbations can do. Okay, I'll start with the monolayer, and I'll show how this Hamiltonian gets derived. So here is the monolayer crystalline arrangement. The lattice is honeycomb, therefore it contains two atoms in the unit cell. These atoms are carbons. Electrons are taken into the band structure that we're discussing here that produces this kind of dispersion near the Fermi level. These electrons belong to the pz orbitals. Those orbitals, if you look from the top, look like circles. If you look from the side, they would look like handles. But we're looking from the top, and we're studying how those overlap with each other to use side-body model to describe electrons in the lattice. One can use various approaches. In DFT, one can use plane waves. Also, one can use the symmetry analysis to write down chronologically all possible invariants of the symmetry group C6V plus translations of this crystal. Results are the same, except that in tight binding model, you can get a feeling about what is bigger and what is smaller. So in the tight binding model, we have to consider two sublattices, A and B, and the amplitude of the electron waves of block states on the two sublattices. And the 2x2 Hamiltonian that we're talking about here is the Hamiltonian that characterizes the electron amplitudes on the two sublattices. The two sublattices have the same on-site energy for electrons, and I'll simply set this value to zero energy from which I'll count energy. And then for the off-diagonal element of the Hamiltonian, I need to take into account the electron possibility to hop from one side to another. The strongest hop couples the three closest sides. And in parameterization that we'll use, it's called gamma node. And for example, for the AB overlap between two sublattice block states, we'll have to take into account the number three of the neighbors, which have equivalent amplitude of the overlap, for example, for this B side, three neighboring A sides. And what we also have to do is to take into account that the plane wave amplitudes of the block states at these three surrounding A sites are different. And if I take the states exactly in the corner of the Brillouin zone, which is hexagonal, in the corner of the hexagonal Brillouin zone of this honeycomb lattice, I'll have to sum together three factors related to how the surrounding sites arrange around this site, and also dependent on the wave number of the electron. The wave number I've taken exactly in the Brillouin zone corner. And the this is where the user computer usually helps, because you don't have to write three where you're there. And the way how the phases are arranged for displaying waves in the Brillouin zone corner is that for this one, the phase as compared to the middle one will be shifted by minus 2 pi over 3 phase, and for this one the phase will be shifted by plus 2 pi over 3. And then if you sum the three amplitudes together, you get a zero. And what does it reflect? It reflects that precisely in the Brillouin zone corner there is some double degeneracy of states, that the two sublattice states can be separated and coincide at zero energy. Now if we depart a little bit from the Brillouin zone corner by some value of momentum, which I'll call the belly momentum, momentum counted from the Brillouin zone corner k, then what I'll have to do with this expression, I'll have to expand it, so this is zero, I'll have to expand it into the powers of a small parameter, the product of atomic interatomic distances, and the small value of the daily momentum p. And the expansion in the first order will give me the effective Dirac velocity for the electrons in the vicinity of the Brillouin zone corner. Now here one has to be careful. This is only approximate. This is the first expansion term. This expansion term does give the Dirac and Valtonyan, does give me this matrix structure for the 2x2 matrix characterizing the coupling of the block states in the vicinity of the Brillouin zone corner. But it's only approximate. This expansion can in principle continue. So here is the new graph, which is the experimental one, which measures, which actually photographs the states of electrons which obey this Dirac Hamiltonian. And what is shown here is really a photograph of those electrons made optically using angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy. What photoemission spectroscopy does, photon comes, kicks out electron from the lattice, and after electrons kicked out and registered, the amplitudes of electron waves originating on one sublattice and the other sublattice, they interfere, and from that one can extract information about the mutual phase shift between A and B sublattice components of the electron states inside the lattice. So what the diagram in the top shows is the linear dispersion of the electrons in the band, which is quite heavily doped in this experiment. It shows the linear dispersion corresponding to the Dirac spectrum. And at the same time, the color plot in the bottom shows the distribution of the intensity of the outcoming electrons in vacuum, where the A and B sublattice components interfere and sum together. And it shows that there was a phase shift that corresponds exactly to what we expect as a phase shift for the Dirac electrons related to the Berry phase of those electrons. So this measurement has been done at Berkeley by Eli Rotenberg's group. And also what you may notice if you look carefully at this picture is that the shapes that you can see as isoenergetic cuts in each of the six corners of the Brillouin zone And those cuts are taken at energy which is not very huge. It's only about half electron volt from the Dirac point. They are slightly distorted. They are triangulated. And this reflects that the actual crystal gives you a band of a finite width. And in terms of this expansion, you can characterize the deformation by producing higher and higher order terms of this expansion, which will be responsible for the triangular shape of the constant energy slices in the band structure. Now, when you have a triangulation in the dispersions, it means that changing the value momentum to minus value momentum changes energy. So this is not a circle. This looks like a triangle. And this is the first point for me to state that in graphene, one cannot do physics just concentrating on the Dirac equation looking for electrons in one valley. One has to treat two valleys simultaneously because they are related by the fundamental symmetry transformation, the time inversion. And if you do the time inversion for the plane waves, you have to invert both p and the large, the value of the wave vector in the Brillouin zone k, so that by the time inversion you change p to minus p, but you have to take the state in the opposite value k prime. So you have to take those two relays simultaneously just to be able to work with a system which is time inversion, so work with Hamiltonian which is time inversion. So what does it mean in terms of writing down the formal expression, for example, for the monolayer graphene, continuing this expansion in the power of the electron momentum? One has to write down a term which would be similar to what I have written down for bilayer graphene, quadratic in the momentum. But now one has to provide it with an additional quantum number, which is the Bailey index, which I take here using the matrix, Pauli matrix tau. So for the components of the block states on the two sublevels of MB, I'll use the isospin sigma. For the Bailey components, for the Bailey quantum number, I'll use the quantum number tau. It also will mean that I may be able to extend the form of the Hamiltonian of bilayer, adding some additional terms. And all the terms which one can add to the Hamiltonian, they have to obey some symmetry requirements. Those symmetry requirements are the time inversion. For example, this guy is time inversion symmetric. And it's time inversion symmetric because momentum changes sign. And also each of the matrices, sigma and tau separately, they change their sign upon the time inversion. So on the left-hand side of this board, I have listed the combinations of these Pauli matrices which act in the sublattice space and the valley space. And I arrange them in a particular groups, in particular combinations, which characterize irreducible presentations, irreducible representations of the symmetry group of the monolayer graphene, which is which include C6C transformations, and which are rotations and inversions and mirror reflections, and also the translations. By the way, the states that I have to consider the subject of this Hamiltonian are no more two-component spinners. They have to be four-component spinners, and the way how I have to take this into account is by treating the states in the two valleys on the equal footing, and just by convenience I choose to arrange the four amplitudes in the way that the order in which I count components on the sublattices and the opposite vertices is inverted, and also it helps to have easier writing if the amplitude sign in the second value for the A side is taken into mind. So I started to go into more and more complex and formal, and at this point I want to show you how this bilayer Hamiltonian has been obtained, where does it come from, starting from the lattice model. And also, this will be the way to start adding terms here and showing what they do, what interesting things were, or spectacular visually things they can do with the band structure of the electrons. So at this point, I need to show one slide, which I had no chance to reproduce on the board. And this is a side view of the bilayer lattice, which demonstrates that in this lattice I have two honeycomb monolayers, arranged according to what is called Bernal stacking. That is, for one of the sides in one layer, there is another side in the other layer just above it. But for the other two sides in each one in each other layer, there is no neighbor underneath. They sit either above the middle of hexagon, or they sit underneath the middle of hexagon in the other layer. Then if I want to describe the tie binding model for such an arrangement, what I do, I first of all take into account the couplings between sublattice components of the block states within each layer. Then I take into account the coupling of the amplitudes of the block states on the sides, on the sublattices which sit on the top of each other. And for a moment I ignore possible couplings of the other type. This one would couple the sides which do not sit on the top of each other directly, but I'll tell you what it does a little bit later. So what I have to do now, I have to work with four sublattices. So I have to start even in one valley. I have to start now with a 4x4 matrix, not 2x2, because I have four sublattices. And the way how I arrange the components of this matrix will be that there will be two sides which do not sit on the top of each other, which are kind of weaker coupled. And I put the amplitudes corresponding to them together in one block. And then I put the other two amplitudes of the electron waves sitting on this kind of dimer, which will be strongly coupled on the top of each other. Within each layer, I have result of the hopping which is now represented by this orthogonal term, which corresponds to coupling of two sublattices which belong to the same layer, or this one which couples two sublattices in the other layer. And then there will be the term which couples two sublattices which sit on the top of each other. The rest, what I have not written down, I put equal to zero, which makes it a very simple matrix which one can diagonalize numerically or analytically. And one can also do something better with it, which I'll describe in a minute. So what is shown here is graphics showing the dispersion of the four bands, which are bilayer bands close to the Brillouin-Zond corners. There are two split bands, and those split bands correspond to the electrons which sit on the electron amplitudes. We sit on the double sides, the sides which have the partner just above each other. And the lower energy bands correspond to the states which are weakly coupled. They correspond to the states which sit on the single side, the sides which find the next neighbor, which do not find the next neighbor, the closest neighbor in the next layer underneath. And then what I want to say is that for low energy properties of the bilayer. Those split bands, they would not matter. I would only be interested to look at the low energy states, which close to the horizon corner look like those parabolic bands. And to get rid of this high energy corner, one can do the Schrieffer-Wolf transformation and project this problem using second order perturbation theory onto the problem characterizing the states sitting on the disconnected sides. And the interpretation of why this Hamiltonian is parabolic is quite simple. To propagate from a site which doesn't have the coupling to the other layer directly, electrons have to hop onto the site which belongs to their layer, get mixed up with the wave function, get mixed up together with the second layer, and then undergo another hop already through the coupling in the second layer. So there are two pi operators which have to be applied one after the other. That's why the Hamiltonian that now is a projected Hamiltonian characterizing only the low energy electron states has the all diagonal parts which are quadratic in the electron number. Of course, you may say this is only approximation because there are other things that I may have to take into account. And then this simple and nice Hamiltonian will slightly change. I have an excuse for doing what I do by two reasons. One is we know parameters coming from bulk graphite, and we have an excuse, quantitative excuse, to do what we do. And the other thing is that nice picture on the right-hand side corner, which shows the measured arc spectral bilayer graphene, showing exactly the kind of band structure I described. Now, what's the next thing I wanted to do? Next thing I would like to say is that the two Hamiltonians, which are written here, the monolayer and the bilayer Hamiltonian, they can be now used in conjunction to quantum Hall effect physics, because the system is two-dimensional. And in the magnetic field, the spectrum falls apart into discrete Landau levels. And if I add the external magnetic field and vector potential corresponding to that, so the momentum operator, I can do it by simply using elongated momentum in the definitions of these operators. And then this operator, now it will be really an operator P, will decide that it will be nothing but the raising or descending operator in the set of simple Landau levels of electrons that you would describe with the parabolic spectrum. And what it does, this produces the Landau level spectrum of electrons in the monolayer. Which would be not equidistant, which would go as a square root of n and also proportional to the square root of the distribution would be proportional to the square root of magnetic field. And each of the states in the spectrum would be twelve-fold degenerate. And the twelve-fold degeneracy comes from counting two valleys and also two components of the two spin states that electron has, and spin is actually mentioned the first time in this talk. For the bilayer, the Hamiltonian, as written here, produces a spectrum which is almost equidistant at high excitation energies in the conduction band as positive energies, and valence band and the negative energies, with a feature that also, all energy states are four-fold degenerate. The Landau level of degenerate energy is degenerate twice times more. And this is because this Hamiltonian has square of the raising and descending operators standing appear in it. And therefore, there are two states which respond to the electronic wave functions, Landau functions, zero and first, which are nullified by the operator pi square. And as a result, the n equal to zero and n equal to 1/3 both have zero energy. The whole spectrum looks like the spectrum of electrons in a magnetic field with parabolic dispersion. So this is nothing but h bar cyclic energy. And then multiply by n minus root of n minus 1, which becomes almost equidistant in high energies, and tells you that at zero and the first Landau levels are additional energy. So this Landau level spectrum, there's two Landau level spectra. They have consequences for the quantum Hall effect, for the sequence of integer quantum Hall effect plateaus in monolayers and bilayers. For example, for this one, the sequence of quantized platters goes with filling factors, which are like that. And for this one, the sequence of quantum Hall effect platters goes with the filling factors, which are factors of four integer multiplied by integer, with the feature that there is the A times E square H step across the zero filling factor, which reflects this eightfold degeneracy of the zeroth Landau level. So this is what single particle picture will tell us. However, nowadays, the samples in which quantum Hall effect studied are of extreme quality, and the correlation effects can be seen and investigated, including the fractional quantum Hall effect. And the high degeneracy, even of the zeroth Landau level in the monolayer, and even the additional degeneracy in the bilayer, makes the problem quite exciting, because in this case, you have SU4 symmetric system, and then you may start asking ugly questions. What the local symmetry breaking in the interaction between electrons do to the SU4 degenerate quantum Hall effect state. And for the bilayers, it's even more complicated. So this is one of the interesting issues one can look at in relation to graphene physics with interactions. Now, how much time I have? 10 minutes. Now, how do I get rid of? Okay, I know how to get rid of the screen. Now I would like to go into something which is less known. And I'll leave the promise that I'll describe what external fields can do to break symmetry of the bilayer to ask you the question if you will be still interested. But I'll try to give you a feeling about what is discussed in relation to how electrons themselves can cause the crystal to lose its symmetry. Now, in terms of the bilayer, by saying that I'm looking at electrons at lower energies, I simply make its lattice simplified by wiping away the sites which correspond to those strongly coupled pairs. And that makes the bilayer lattice and monolayer lattice looking exactly the same, so that the sense of the operator sigma becomes exactly the same, and the rules of the operations with them are exactly the same. And then, what one has to do with interactions? Well, first of all, when interaction is strong, the first thing one can try is to screen. We know that metals in which interactions are extremely strong are still described using single particle pictures. The spectra, the ARPA spectra I have shown you, they are quite good in terms of quantitative description using parameters extracted from well, graphite, which is more like a metal than graphene itself. So that interaction somehow, the role of the interaction is somehow diminished in both cases. And the way how it does, you have interaction which is screened by the polarization, the virtual processes in the electron system itself, so that the actual interaction you see is not the one, is not the cool interaction you had from the very beginning, but it is screened by the fluctuations in the electronic system. And now, there are two ways to proceed. One is to just take the first order in the Coulomb interaction at any point and to guess, and then just to investigate what kind of effect it gives, or to proceed with screening and have a justifiable application of a perturbation theory. For graphene, for monolayer graphene, the very interesting analysis that Maria Vizminiana, Panka, Guinea, and Gonzalez did in 99 was that to see how the Barrett-Coulomb interaction affects the linear dispersion of the electrons, this parameter V in the drag velocity. What they found was that V undergoes the logarithmic correction. Where P node is a momentum scale at which you have to cut off the use of such linear dispersion in Newtonian, which means something comparable to the bandwidth. And this is the normalization of velocity, which is now being seen in at least one measurement by Andre, who's studying the point. I'm not aware of other experiments which are as clean as his. And the experiment of this kind requires very high quality, very clean graphene to be able to reach the small values of the Fermi momentum of the electron. And the ugly reality is that there are fluctuations in the carrier density which one has to beat. And if graphene is not clean enough, if it's lying in a dirty substrate, the inhomogeneity of charge would hide this normalization of velocity. Then there was an additional development in this direction. I'll say in a minute. There was a recent development in this field by Son, who used a large number of four quantum numbers that electrons in graphene have, twice spin and twice event. And he employed the 1 over n expansion that you would get from this screening of the Coulomb interaction, because this polarization loop is proportional to the number of species in the electronic loop. And by doing the RG analysis of how velocity evolves, what Son found was that the numerical factor can be obtained in 1 over n expansion. One can question how big is one quota or small. And if you employ the RG flow, not to velocity, but to the electron dispersion, what you find that it is approximately power 0.8, slightly less than. So in terms of a number, there is a combination of 1 over n and pi square and some numerical factor, which combines together into numerical factor here using the 1 over n expansion, which is something like 0.2.
Numerical factor there, which mentioned something like?
0.2. Another thing is that for the Scherzberg interactions, the normalization doesn't matter so much unless you start making them interplay with the Kuhlmann interaction. And there was an interesting study by Aliner and Foster, sorry, by Aliner and Zwelik, who tried to get some phase transitions coming from the normalization of the interaction constant with the monolayer, and they came up with a very pessimistic answers that maybe something may happen, but at extremely low energy scale of microelectron walls, and therefore this is not what I would like to discuss in the last 5 minutes. What I would like to discuss in the last 5 minutes is that for bilayers, interactions are also strong, and the trick with the screening has to be employed straight away. And the same conclusion that now we get the interaction, which is suppressed by screening due to the multiple number of species of electrons, can be used to analyze what happens with the interaction constant and parameters of the bilayer. So this work has been done, or at least attempted, by several groups. We looked at the normalization of the effective mass parameter, and we found that the there is some normalization of the mass, actually making mass slightly lighter. However, the numerical value here was so small that this isn't what one has to keep in mind. Oskar Wafik, he started a very interesting business analyzing how this short-range interaction constants, which correspond to interactions of fluctuations breaking symmetry of the crystal locally, how do those get renormalized. And the number of interaction constants one has to follow in such analysis is determined by the number of ways or irreducible representations, number of ways you can break symmetry of the crystal locally. And there are actually 9 irreducible representations in the symmetry group. One of them is just unit representation, the trivial one, which doesn't correspond to actually any local symmetry breaking. This one would be characterized by the constant that is 1 over n, which is nothing but the interaction screen, the full interaction screen. And then for all the others, the joint RG flow takes a complex form, and I'm going to frighten you with the expression. Is it possible to get rid of the screen now? So I have hidden some set of diagrams that were used in this analysis. This is the same set as Oscar used and myself, Lemonic and Aliner and myself used. And the RG equations one gets, I'm not going to write all 8 of them, I just write down the structure. Tell you what to see on the board. all the constants get coupled to each other. There are 8 nonlinear equations, and it means that the RG flow should be expected to be quite complicated, to have certain instabilities. And one thing one can notice is that there is this term in the RG equations which tells that the positive constants, they get reduced, and this term comes from simply screening. And the same term also tells that if there are negative constants, they get accelerated, and therefore this is the first thing to expect, that there will be some instability in the, as a result of this normalization. When constants get larger, at some point they get unit value, the interaction energy becomes comparable to the band energy, and then you should expect the phase transition. And there is another term here which tells that there is kind of a source for all constants characterizing symmetry interaction, symmetry grating fluctuations. And this term works only for one of the constants, the one which corresponds to the reducible representation E2. And this representation characterizes the following. It characterizes the effect you would get if you take the crystal lattice and stretch it. In terms of the phase transition, such interaction constant of a negative sign would cause would be a mnemonic transition in the electronic liquid, which would simply mimic the effect of the unilateral deformation. It wasn't the first that mnemonic liquids were discussed in graphene. Before that, there was a big story in ITC superconductors and in flinktites, where allegedly those have been observed. Now, there is also spin in the game, so that one can talk about ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic states. And there are interesting options which are called spin flux states, which generate terms in the Hamiltonian which are similar to the spin orbit coupling you had here in the institute workshop, which is about topological insulators. The whole field appeared due to the work of Kane and Milley, who introduced intrinsic spin orbit coupling in graphene physics. One of the phases that may emerge in the bilayer due to this renormalization of interaction constants is actually the phase in which the symmetry broken state would mimic the graphene layer with generated spin orbit coupling. I would like to make this comment not to leave the question hang, where this term comes from, the specific one which promotes pneumatic phase. And the answer is that it comes from the Coulomb interaction, which is screened, interplaying with the structure of the electronic wave functions on the lattice characterized by this Dirac type Hamiltonian. And due to this coupling, this is the only one, this is the only interaction constant which can be fired by the most symmetric interaction, the Coulomb interaction. But after it is fired, it can start accelerating all the others. And if the constants which we actually do not know were non-zero, or in this symmetry breaking interaction channel, were non-zero or were sufficiently large, the RG flow can end up almost anywhere. So before I finish, I would like to show one slide.
N is 4.
Of course, this is not a big N, but still 1/4 square is already 10% only. It's not so bad. So what I want to show as the last slide is what are the numerous options that attempt solving this normalization group equations produced, starting with different initial conditions for running constants. So basically, us means Jono Limonic, who did most of the hard part in that, and also, as far as I know, Oscar Vafik is doing independently, is trying to start with different initial coupling constant conditions and see where the RD flow ends up. I have to admit that whatever intuition we had to expect, to predict, or to anticipate the results, they, at least in our case, fail completely. And the reason is because the coupling constants that matter, when they enter the energy of the phase of particular structure, including anti-ferromagnetic, including phases in which there is opening of spins, they come in quite complex subdivisions, so that it's not just one constant that determines the outcome of the RG flow in terms of what phase is formed. And also, the flow itself is highly unstable, and the solution of this linear differential equations sometimes end in unexpected corners of the parametric space. So what we found, at least in our analysis, is that playing with various initial conditions for the RG flow, we can see an emetic phase. We can see an anti-ferromagnetic phase in which there is spin polarization in the opposite direction on the two sublattices of the bilayer, the ones which are left after the eliminated of the double tanks. Then we find the spin flux phase in which the order parameter which is generated affects the Hamiltonian in the same way as spin orbit coupling would do. So this is the spin flux phase. And in very particular corners of initial parameters requiring relatively large values of starting interaction constants, we find a superconducting phase, a triplet superconducting state, and also in very, very rare, for very, very rare extreme initial conditions for the RG, we see a ferroelectric phase, which would correspond to that one sublattice or one layer would be charged against the other by layer, which would open the symmetry gap in the space.
Using zero doping?
Yes, it's all done in the following way. We do the RG, and then we stop at the energy at which the combination of interaction constants for each of the possible phases for which parameter or the parameter we write down based on symmetry would shoot unitary. That's where the response function to the fluctuation with the structure of the order parameter of the phase would start diverging. So we don't see an infinite number of possibilities. We see five, and I would say the three most likely ones are pneumatic phase, anti-ferromagnetic phase, and the spin flux phase. Oscar may comment on that. He may find something different. I also want to say that there are other schools of thought in this field who simplify the picture and try to make shortcuts. I don't find the shortcuts justifiable, and I notice anomalies in the treatment that results from the shortcuts, for example, reducing the number of interaction constants which are considered, or projecting the basis states onto some pre-selected basis to make calculations simpler. We found that this is dangerous and gives definitely wrong results as compared, or different results as compared to the analysis which includes everything at the beginning. So this is a part which ends in unknown. It looks like we did some work, but it's not settled. And the experimental observations, they also are conflicting. There is a set of experiments at several different groups, which find, well, one in Riverside by Ginny Long, another at Harvard, this is Amir Jacoby, and they find the gap states in the bilayer which would require an assumption of either antiferromagnetic state or spin flux state or ferroelectric state. However, there are some differences between these two experiments in the results, so that one cannot say that they see the same thing for sure. And there is an observation in Manchester that reports a gapless but stay different from just simple bilayer with parabolic dispersion, which we interpreted as a pneumatic phase. This is a difficult interpretation because the formations, the straining of graphene would lead to the same symmetry breaking, so that here we have to stretch a little bit the interpretation to make it many body. The argument why this was treated as pneumatic was because the same behavior was seen in a number of samples, not only qualitatively but quantitatively, and it would be strange if strain would be exactly the same in several samples produced by exfoliation and then a complex procedure. So this is an open field, and this is where at least one full day of our conference was spent, and a lot of debates, so that we have to continue those debates in the program, and we had another day discussing bilayer physics as a separate. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.